know, it's technically 11:13, but it looks like everybody's all ready to go, so we can go ahead and start then. It was brought to my attention last week that it's traditional to start Sunday school with prayer, which is the sort of thing you forget when you're really nervous about trying to make people think you know what you're talking about. So we will go ahead and start with a quick prayer this week. Our Father in heaven, God of true religion, we thank you that as we come to you, who are truth, whose image is in us, that we are able to worship you and to hear your word this morning. And now, Lord, as we gather for Sunday school, I just ask that you would give me clarity of mind and speech, and likewise to the audience, to consider those religions of man's best attempts to be righteous without you. And Lord, help us to appreciate true religion in light of man-made religion, to see the good and beauty in it. And Lord, equip us to be able to share your gospel with the lost. We ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. All right, so this week we're going to switch from a focus on Islam to a focus on Hinduism. And obviously this is the last week of this month, so we're going to have that month-long break of prayer meeting in this hour next month. At least that's my understanding. Somebody from the session shout at me if I'm saying that wrong. But anyway, so for this this week, we're just going to get started talking about Hinduism, attempt to lay out the sort of the basic understanding of what the religion of Hinduism teaches. And in transitioning from Islam to Hinduism, it's not just a transition from the Middle East to the Indian subcontinent. It's not only a transition from the second to the third largest world religion, but it's really a quite radical shift in terms of just the nature of the religion, the structure of the religion, the emphases of the religion. And I think it's actually useful to us to briefly contrast Islam with now moving into Hinduism. So, you know, Islam is in a lot of ways relatively easy for the Christian to understand. The basic structure of it, as we've seen over the last few weeks, is relatively simple. There's God. He wants you to do good things. Do them. And that's Islam. Again, the name of it, submission, is just obedience. And frankly, I think we raised this point in earlier weeks. In a lot of ways, Islam doesn't look very different than sort of a legalistic Christianity. You know, the Christianity of a lot of cultural Christians in America might not look that distinct from Islam. Again, just do good things. God will like you if you do. So it's not that difficult to for us to grasp the idea of Islam. Hinduism can be harder to get inside of, can be harder to appreciate and understand where they're coming from. It's not simply that they have different emphases, but really they're not only getting to a different place, but they're getting to a different sort of place and starting from a different sort of place. So what I want to begin by doing is kind of giving a look at the basic structure of Hinduism, almost as you would hear it if you're on the airplane and you've got the fellow who's reading from the Hindu something, and you're like, hey, so what do you believe? And you know, how is he going to present Hinduism to you? And very often what they will say is that Hinduism, and they'll sort of smile as they say this, Hinduism is not an organized religion. And that's actually a pretty decent way to begin thinking about what makes Hinduism somewhat distinct. And we'll also look at some of its history as we progress through why Hinduism is not an organized religion in the sense that we might think of it. Hindus will emphasize the fact that they do not have a spiritual leader of any sort. They do not have really a religious organization of any sort. They do not have really a coherent and defined set of scriptures, though that could be overemphasized. They do have things that are generally regarded as scriptures. But again, it's not like the Bible or the Quran. It's a looser collection of religious teaching. And then they also don't really have any defined set of doctrines that you must hold. In fact, many Hindus will tell you, you can be a Hindu Christian. You can be a Hindu Muslim. I remember some years ago when I was first studying Hinduism to teach about it in my apologetics class, and I went to this Hindu website, understand Hinduism from the Hindus. And there was this entire section of this Hindu website devoted to talking about how great Buddhism was. They're somewhat related, but they're not the same thing at all. It would be like going to a Jewish website and finding this section about how glorious Christianity was. And it was striking and also very revelatory about how the Hindu thinks about religion. So what we're going to be looking at with Hinduism is just a religion that in a lot of ways thinks very differently about religion than a monotheist would typically think. Backing up a little bit, just as far as the where we're going to encounter Hindus in the workplace or in life, there's roughly a billion or so Hindus, is what most estimates would say. It is the third largest organized religion after Christianity and Islam. It is also something which has spawned many offshoots. Buddhism is considered in many ways an offshoot of Hinduism. You also have smaller sects like Sikhism, Jainism, and just a host of Hindu denominations, practically. Essentially, just little splinter sections of Hinduism. So it is quite influential in sort of the spread of world religions. It is centered primarily, as I'm sure you guys would know, centered in the Indian subcontinent primarily. If you encounter it today, you and I, we're most likely to encounter it in one of two places. A, we're going to encounter it from an Indian national, somebody from India, or we're going to encounter it from a yuppie. Nice, white, American, whatever. That's going to be your other major place you're going to encounter is somebody who is just very similar culturally to you and me, honestly. Especially generally fairly well-educated, fairly upper class, is an area where there's a lot of appeal currently culturally to these Eastern, whether Hinduism or Buddhism, or just the sort of spiritual but not religious catch-all category, which is deeply influenced by them. So it's kind of an odd split in terms of thinking about where are you going to encounter this? Well, either you're going to encounter it with somebody who is culturally very different from you, or you're likely to encounter it with somebody who's culturally very similar to you. And of course, they're going to understand and interpret Hinduism somewhat differently. And that's actually one thing that makes it a little challenging to talk about Hinduism qua Hinduism, because even more so than any religion with a billion people is going to have some differences of opinion on all the details. But Hinduism specifically, as we said, not an organized religion. What you're going to see is just a widespread of how it's understood, how it's interpreted, etc. And I think some particular distinctions that we can make at the start to help us clarify the different categories of Hindu thought we may encounter is, first of all, a distinction between what you might call theological Hinduism and what you might call practical Hinduism. We're going to focus primarily, at least at first, on theological Hinduism, the Hinduism you're going to read about in a book, from some Hindu missionary or whatever, or they don't exactly have missionaries, but a Hindu attempting to explain his religion. The more formal theological Hinduism is often somewhat distinct from the Hinduism you're actually going to see practiced by a typical Indian. And then also, you're going to have a distinction between sort of traditional Indian Hinduism and what you might call Western pop Hinduism, which again has a lot of bleed over into New Age, a lot of bleed over into, again, spiritual but not religious type categories. So what I'm going to try to do, especially today, is start from the core of theological proper Hinduism. Look at what a Hindu theologian, so to speak, would say. And then from that can also help to illuminate our understanding of how the people we're actually likely to encounter might view and act out the religion of Hinduism. So with all that being noted, Hinduism then begins, and this is actually quite important to understand Hinduism begins basically before history, or at least before we have records of history. You have at the very sort of the earliest mists of historical, mythological, that sort of boundary where we're just starting to have historical records. Hinduism is in some ways already there, or at least the roots of Hindu thought. It's generally considered, well, obviously Christianity starts at the beginning. If you're a Christian, you would say that. But by religious sort of people who categorize religions, Hinduism is often considered the oldest religion. It is, again, it has roots going back almost to before we have historical records at all. And the very first religious documents of Hinduism, the first things that we would call Hindu doctrine, are what are called the Vedas, V-E-D-A-S. And the Vedas are the closest thing the Hindu has to scriptures, as we would think of them. So the Vedas are described by Hindus as basically being, generally they would say they're inspired, but their idea of inspiration is a little bit different from ours, where we think of, again, God has this message, he reveals it to this man, he records it. You know, that's the Christian understanding, that's the Jewish understanding, that's the Islamic understanding. That's not so much the Hindu understanding. And I've struggled to come up with maybe a helpful analogy that would help us to get how the Hindu thinks of inspiration. And of course, I'm limited by being a Christian. I don't think of it this way. But I think for the Christian, perhaps the best analogy we can draw is the way that we might say that, a piece of writing by Augustine or by John Calvin or Martin Luther is influenced by the Holy Spirit, in the sense that he's not directly revealing truth to them in the way that he did to Mark or Luke, etc. But of course, they're a Christian. They have the Holy Spirit within them. They're providing useful insights from a respected, mature believer. And so we take it with weight, but not as absolutely a revealed word of God. And that's probably the best comparison to give us sort of a sense of how the Hindu tends to think of his scriptures, that they are shaped by the action of God, Brahman, and they are very useful. They're authoritative in the sense that they're verified by experience is really the best way to look at it. Generations of spiritual saints and sages have reaffirmed these teachings. People have found them useful. They've moved people in the direction of enlightenment and of what is often called God realization. So they're useful. So they essentially attest to their revelation through their effect on those who read them, is the view typically of, again, the Vedas, which are the most sort of the bottom layer, the most foundational layer of Hindu doctrine. From the Vedas, then, you have there's various documents, but the next major type of document is the Upanishads, which are more or less commentaries on the Vedas. And then you have various epics, actually. Perhaps the most loved Hindu scripture is the Bhagavad Gita, which is a relatively short work that is sort of this epic story of this soldier who's basically having an existential crisis, and a incarnation of God called Krishna. Krishna appears to him and basically walks him through what's giving him trouble and how to fix it. And we'll talk a little bit about what Krishna reveals to Arjuna, who's the soldier. We'll talk about that in a bit. But so you've got these layers of, again, useful doctrine, authoritative, inspired, but not quite in the same way that the Christian would think of it. And the picture that we get out of all this doctrine is a picture, essentially a picture of drawn by men trying to get a picture of God. And I think, to me, if we're looking for themes or things that contrast Christianity from Hinduism, to me, as I study Hinduism, the thing that I keep coming back to is thank God, literally, for revelation. Thank God for the Word. Thank God for the Bible. Because that really is the major distinction between Hinduism and Christianity. To be perfectly honest, if we didn't have the revelation of God, I'd probably be something that looked more or less like a Hindu. Because it's practically the only game left in town at that point. If you don't have God's revelation saying, this is who I am. This is who you are. This is how you get right with me. If we didn't have that, basically, you're left with Hinduism or something that looks very similar to it. So to survey, then, how the Hindu builds this picture without revelation, trying to get a picture of God and man through, again, this building, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the epics, this building mass of doctrine that develops. It's helpful, again, to look historically. And actually, let's even look at European religious history. You know, wherever we go in the world, we tend to see the first layers of religion in, again, Norse or Greek thought, and also among the fathers of the Hindus, is some sort of polytheism. Everything's God. You know, there's a crack of lightning, so there's a thunder god. There's the tree, you know, the grass growing out of the dirt, so we have the grass-growing god. You know, everything is a god. And so that's maybe your basic, that's your entry-level religion in most cultures historically. And to be perfectly honest, it's just kind of dumb. And people, you know, if you look philosophically at the at that view of God, what you see is all cultures generally that last long enough tend to grow out of a polytheism into a view of there's sort of lurking in the background, lurking in the shadows. I think there's some sort of God. There's something there. We see it in the Greeks as they develop and their philosophers think about religion. We start to see in Plato and Aristotle an idea of there's something higher. Because again, just philosophically, if everything is God, where did the gods come from? You know, what created the gods? Should we follow? And there's, if you read Greek dialogues in particular, talking about ethics, there's this fascinating dilemma: which gods do we obey? You know, which gods do we model our behavior on? Just polytheism practically just doesn't work as a religious system. And in general, if you have a culture that starts polytheistically, what you will see, if they don't get run over by some other culture and conquered, if they have time to develop a religion, you'll see them shifting out of polytheism simply because if you live in it long enough, you start to see it just doesn't work. And that's basically what we see happening sort of organically in what becomes then Hindu culture. Is they start with a polytheistic kind of idea, but they, like most polytheistic cultures, just they see dimly, murky in the background, God, capital G, God. Something that is more than simply, you know, the God of this and the God of that and the God of the other thing. And so in the Vedas, we start to see then the saints and the sages and the various largely unnamed people who put together these doctrines and teachings. We start to see them speak of the one. The one for the Hindu is Brahman. And so we start to get, again, a sort of a fuzzy background picture of the true God, the God behind the various manifestations of this God and that God and the other thing. And that's actually one misunderstanding that Christians sometimes have about Hinduism, is we think of it, you know, the religion of 10,000 gods. And yes, but no. Because ultimately the Hindu does believe in one God, of whom all things, including actually you and me, and also the 10,000 gods, are manifestations. He's the God in the shadows, the God in the background, who, if we can become enlightened, we begin to move past the illusions, begin to move past the various manifestations of him that we see in the other gods, in you and me, and we can see true God, Brahman, ultimately. So we see that development in the Vedas from polytheism to a God in the background, Brahman.
Do we know who wrote the Vedas?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no.
How many?
That's a good question that I should know the answer to. It's going to depend partially on your, what sect of Hinduism. Again, there's some people are going to consider authoritative, some that you know, you can be a Hindu and think none of them are authoritative. I think it's about a dozen. I can't give you an exact figure. Well before Christ. Like maybe the millennium or so before Christ, they're being put together. Yeah. And then again, the Upanishads follow after that. I think it's, Sanskrit primarily. Because these are the Indo-Aryans that, again, basically they're from somewhere in either Europe or Asia is the consensus. So that's helpful where they came from. But that's the culture then that settles in the Indus River Valley. That's actually where they get the term Hindu, is you had Muslim invaders coming to roll over them. These poor people have basically been rolled over by every major empire since the Muslims. You have the Muslims conquer them, and then the Europeans come and conquer them, which actually becomes significant later on as we talk about evangelism. But anyway, so the Muslims actually name them Hindus simply because they needed some name for those people in the Indus River Valley that we keep killing. So Indus becomes Hindu, and that becomes the foundation for that name. So again, it's that civilization, that culture is where these documents or teachings are being developed.
Is one Veda written by one person, or are they compilations of sayings?
They're somewhat obscure, sort of philosophical type sayings. That's partially why the Upanishads get written, is to clarify the teachings of the Vedas. I've not read the Vedas extensively, to be honest. What they generally are is snippets. You know, again, sayings. Think sort of a compilation, like Proverbs kind of idea. Again, not so much history or anything like that. There are some prayers. There are some things to meditate on, So essentially just picture some guru type, some religious teacher who's just, you know, saying this and that, this other useful thing. We're writing it down, and it gets compiled into then the Vedas. So this is another factor of, again, the Hindu thought that says we don't want to know to whom it was revealed. We do know sometimes. But instead of God came to Jesus, God came to, well, God was Jesus, God came to, you know, Luke, God came to Moses, he revealed these things and they wrote them down. Or God came to Muhammad and he wrote them down. Because you have that sense of direct revelation to a person. The Hindu just has, there was this saint, this holy person who was enlightened, who came up with useful ideas. They've been confirmed by experience subsequently, and so we respect them. So there's much less emphasis on who wrote them. Some of them we have names, some of them we don't. None of them do we know very much at all about. But again, to the Hindu, that's just how religion works, is again, not direct revelation, but more discovery by those who are enlightened. So you have then this, again, so this sort of fuzzy discovery of God behind things. There is a deity, and we don't know very much about him. In fact, the Hindu is very definite about that. The Hindu refuses to put any sort of defining characteristic on Brahman, the god behind, again, the one god. So any sort of characteristic, they say Brahman is not a person. There's no personality, not person in the sense of human being, but again, not a person. He is beyond good and evil. He is essentially any set of opposites that you could define. You know, he is good and not evil. He is a person and not impersonal. He's anything at all. You cannot say that of Brahman. He is everything. He is essentially that from which all pairs of opposites come. So he's explicitly and intentionally undefinable, which is significant for reasons we'll consider in more depth later. So you've got this, again, this picture of God in the background. And then, of course, once you've thought a little bit about God, the next obvious question is, well, what are we? And here is where the Hindu, I think, remember, without the aid of revelation, makes an understandable wrong turn. So basically, he's looking at people, and people are weird, honestly. You look at people, and you have, on the one hand, you have, we are glorious. You look in Genesis, and you have, there's creation, there's sunrises and waterfalls and mountains, and it's all just good. And then we come along, and it's very good. You know, Nick, pat yourself on the back. But truly, God has created a glorious, a wondrous thing in human beings. We are made for communion with him. We are made to walk with God. So you have something that is, again, the very image of God in a creature. And you look at that, oh, wow. And then, of course, on the other hand, you know, the higher you are, the further you fall. And you just look in the news. You look in your own heart. And you have the abject wickedness and perversion and evil of human beings as well. And that's a hard thing to reconcile. You know, think of even last week we talked about how in Islam we see that flattening of those sort of distinctions, of those balances that Christianity is able to hold in tension between, for example, God is sovereign, yet man is free, is responsible for his actions. Islam just flattens that and becomes, you know, just the sovereignty of God. Well, if I was trying to make up a religion, you know, I'm going to have difficulty with those sorts of seemingly paradoxical principles. Like man is glorious, wondrous, made, you know, with the image of God, and yet he is filthy and perverted. What do you do with that? I think it's a striking apologetic for Christianity, actually, that there are so many pairs like that, so many things that fit our experience. Yes, I look on the news, I look at you all, and there is a glory and a beauty to human nature. And yet there's filth. I mean, I just look at myself, and it's disgusting. And Christianity is able to fully, completely encompass both of those things that feel like they ought to be in tension. That are intention. And yet there's an explanation for both. We are created in the image of God, and we are fallen and need to be saved. Well, Hinduism, without the revelation of God, again, is looking at men, humans, and, okay, how do we explain this? And they see clearly enough the image of God in man that, well, they make the understandable step to, well, then man is God, like everything else. So that becomes then the picture of the human, for the Hindu, is that we are God. Incidentally, remember how I said you have the split between sort of traditional Hindu theology and then, you know, pop Western Hinduism? Basically, I just picture, you know, all the Shirley MacLaine types and the New Age types. They're all, you know, sitting here listening to some Hindu theologian lecture. You know, he's just talking and talking, and they're like, and they're like, and you're God. And they're like, yes, I got that. That's good. So essentially, that becomes much more emphasized and disproportionately and out of balance with other Hindu teachings. And again, more that sort of New Age, pop Western Hinduism. Again, it's just your God. But that is definitely something which is a core Hindu belief, is that mankind is essentially God, but you've sort of forgotten, in a sense. You've been weighed down by the world around you, which we'll explain how that happens in a moment. And an illustration that's often given, Hinduism has lots of illustrations, lots of analogies to try to help us understand, again, this fundamentally incomprehensible God. So one illustration that I found helpful for the Hindu view of people is that man is to Brahman as a wave is to the ocean. You know, if you think about it, the wave is part of the ocean, and yet we can sort of distinguish them. And that's then the picture of man for the Hindu is your God, but you can also be thought of distinct from God. And that's then what human beings are at the most basic for the Hindu. And because, remember I said that we sort of are deceived by the world into thinking that we're not God. That actually raises, if we start moving a little more systematically through Hindu doctrine, I think that's about the most helpful starting place for us. Not necessarily where a Hindu would start. If I was teaching, you know, Hinduism to a group of people who were interested in being Hindus, I probably wouldn't start with this. But for Christians, I think it's helpful to start with the idea of Maya, M-A-Y-A. Maya, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, is a Sanskrit word for illusion. And so the world is completely encompassed roundabout with Maya. You're in a bubble of illusion. Nothing is as it appears, including Brahman. When we think of Brahman, we can't think of him because, again, we are persons. We are defined by opposites. I am male and not female. I am alive and not dead. I would like to be good and not bad. All the things that I am and I am not. And so I take that definedness of human nature and I bring it then to Brahman and I try to put that on him. So essentially the difficulty is I am all wrapped up in a world which predisposes me to think in ways that aren't real. Because ultimate reality, again, is in Brahman, who is undefinable outside of logic. Logic would control Brahman. So I just cannot, for the Hindu, possibly get to what God is. And so that's a great difficulty of Hinduism. And if you want Hinduism in a sentence, Hinduism is the discipline of digging out of Maya to enlightenment in God. And that's essentially a summary of what the Hindu is trying to do. So we are in this, if you want to put it in biblical terms, we see through the glass darkly. But for the Hindu, that's the nature of life, which frankly it is. Again, thank God for revelation that clarifies things for us. But they don't have God coming down to lighten up the murk. All they have is the murk of life, of trying to know God. So you're in this completely, it's a logical, rational structure of how we view life, but it's wrong. Logic itself is misleading because it distinguishes, because it says this and not yet, and this and not that, but Brahman is all. And Brahman is all potentiality. Yes?
Are you going to be talking about cults at all over the course of this class?
Yes, but I'm assuming you see a connection that you want to highlight? Or?
No, are you going to talk about Scientology later?
I'll take votes. I'm trying to avoid talking about, you know, every, like, Baha'i and, you know, Jainism and Pastafarianism. If there's interest, I could cover it. I don't have that much familiarity with it. But I could study up for the next 6 months.
No, I was just
wondering. Okay. Did you want to draw a connection to?
Well, no, I mean, there's just a lot of similarities between going through the different stages.
Right.
Going through enlightenment and early evolution.
Right. I mean, frankly, it's a theme of a lot of different, you know, false religion is obviously there's a problem. We can't see. We can't understand. We don't know. So how do we fix that? So, yeah, whether Scientology is a little bit different than, you know, Hinduism and how it began and things like that. But, of course, that's the problem. If you've got a distinct problem of we're sinful and we don't know how to relate to God, well, duh, religions are going to try to fix that. Certainly. Did I see another hand?
Or? So what is the purpose for the Hindu meditation and other practices?
Very good.
I'm sure you're going to get through this.
Right. Well, that ties in very nicely with this idea of Maya and of illusion. So the difficulty is my reason cannot get to Brahman. I cannot, and remember, Brahman is all, everything, this. This is Brahman, you're Brahman, the serial killer is Brahman, the dead animal is Brahman, the dung is Brahman, everything is Brahman. But I cannot get to him rationally, or really by any other natural means. So what the Hindu is looking for is a way to get God realization. He's looking for a way to get that enlightenment of direct experience of God. So meditation is, remember, we're just looking for what has worked for other people. Meditation is viewed as a very effective way. You don't have to do it. You don't need to do it. You're fine if you never meditate, but why wouldn't you? Just like if you're teaching your son to drive, maybe you would say, you know, stay on the right side of the road with a little more force than the Hindu would say meditate. But it's that same idea of just, it's the practical thing to do. Don't speed. Eat your vegetables. Brush your teeth. There's almost that same sense of just, well, this is the practical way to live well. So meditation becomes one way that most Hindus are going to view as a useful way to essentially not so much dismiss the illusion, but get through the illusion to more direct experiential and intuitive knowledge of Brahman. Yes, and then you.
So would a Hindu say that Christianity could be a useful way?
Certainly. Yeah, and that's what they'll say, absolutely. If you want to be a Hindu Christian, go for it. They would typically say it's not the most effective way, but that's your problem. You choose your path. And it may even be the most effective way for you. I'm not going to tell you the most effective way, because really, we're all figuring out as we go. And Christianity is not the path the Hindu would say, which has worked for most people. It's not the best path, but if you want to go for it, that's on you. It's very much you find your own path, but look to, again, the Vedas, the Hindu gurus, teachers. They have mapped better paths. They're more enlightened, so why not follow their direction, would be what they would say. I saw a hand in the back there.
Why does a Hindu want to achieve God realization? Like, what's the point?
Because God. I mean, ultimately, that's what we're made for. And I think, as much as the atheist secular individual in today's society is unnatural. It's weird. That's not been people in any measure of in any number throughout human history. We have the image of God in us. We want God. So for the Hindu, it's just perfectly, well, it's God. What else would you seek?
But is there, like, if the Hindu gets outside of the illusion?
Right.
Like,
what do they get?
Yeah, is there, like, no pain or something?
Yes. So there's levels. I'll sort of summarize, and then we'll look in a little more detail. But basically, in this world, because of illusion, you're bound in the karmic cycle, which is you do good things, and again, we'll look at this in a little more detail later. But basically, you do good things happen to you. You do bad things happen to you. That ties in with reincarnation, because it's, again, multiple life cycles through which you, again, your good deeds may affect you three life cycles later. So that's the cycle that we are all in currently. In each of those cycles, you try to achieve enlightenment, and that gives you a step up for the next cycle. Ultimately, what you desire is to transcend the karmic cycle. And this is something, again, the Bhagavad Gita speaks a lot about, the idea that you need to realize, in Sanskrit, it is tat-tvamasi, which means thou art that. That's what often a Hindu guru will repeatedly say to the disciple as he meditates. As the disciple meditates, the teacher says, again, tattvamasi, thou art that. In other words, thou art Brahman. So what you realize is you are Brahman. You are not the doer of your own actions. You have the image that's often given is of a lotus leaf floating on a pond. So you're just stable. And it's sort of that very other, disconnected sense that you see again from the a Buddhist monk or something like that, that you feel like you're separate from life. That's the goal. You realize then you are Brahman, and ultimately, if you can realize that enough for the Hindu, then you can transcend the cycle of reincarnation, where you're caught up in the karmic cycle, and you ultimately then sort of become part of Brahman. And there's a lot of vagueness about what that would mean. In a sense, you are dissolved into him, but of course you would want to be dissolved into him because he's Brahman. And again, it's very vague. But ultimately, you in some sense become one with Brahman.
So essentially, what's the difference between their ultimate aim and say the Mormons, who final destination is to become like Jehovah? So what fundamentally is the difference?
The Mormon stays himself. The Christian, the Muslim, who wants paradise, you are in paradise. For the Hindu, it's more of a sense of, that a Hindu would object to this, but essentially dissolution. You become one with Brahman. In a sense that, this is again where, because logic, see, I'm trying to impose my logical categories on it, and the Hindu says you can't do it. But if we're going to impose our logical categories on it, essentially you cease to exist and you become Brahman, is the key difference. Did I see other hands? Yes, yes, sir.
How do they determine what's good or bad? What standard is it?
It's a very good question. To some extent, it's out of the Vedas and the Upanishads, once again. But ultimately, we had the same question about Muslims. How do we decide what's good and bad? And read the beginning of Romans, the law written on our heart. So ultimately, there's a sense that it's actually, it's almost like a Ten Commandments that gets written out. Love your family. Do what's good for society. Don't lie. Pretty much your basic moral code that pretty much everybody in every society knows, because we are created in the image of God and we have His law written on our hearts. So that is reflected then in the moral code, which is taught in the Vedas and the Upanishads. And again, if I'm a Hindu parent, I'm just going to tell little Johnny, do good. And I'm going to have in my mind a sense of what that is, because I have the image of God in me.
Brahman is unknowable, but you get illuminated to the point where you know more of who Brahman is. But
see, you know, not in the sense of rationally, you know. Yeah. It's essentially a being kind of knowledge, an intuitive, direct apprehension, as opposed to just I know about would be the distinction they would make. And furthermore, again, if we're thinking how do they know good and evil, Brahman creates good and evil. Brahman has created the moral law, almost like he's created gravity or something like that, but he is beyond it. And again, the enlightened one is also beyond it. So you can be an assassin, you can be a murderer, if you realize it's actually Brahman doing it. So once you become sufficiently enlightened, you then transcend morality. But again, that's getting into theological weeds that the ordinary Hindu is not going to, they're not going to have that level of theological abstraction. Typically, a practicing Hindu is just, I'm trying to be a good person. But if you talk to the Hindu theologian, ultimately, being a good person, like meditation, like other things, is the practice and the preparation for that enlightenment by which you transcend even not just logic, but morality, and then again become absorbed into Brahman. Yes, sir.
Why did it devolve into that? And it would seem that you would run out of source material. Mechanically, think of it, everything is cycling back to Brahman, you would run out of new material.
That's two interesting questions. First interesting answer is they actually appeal to evolution. As human beings cycle into and become Brahman, because this is something they do deal with. I was just reading last night, actually, somebody who is offering an apologetic based on evolution. So as we become Brahman, animals become us. And it's sort of a continual cycle up from the bottom. And remember, Brahman is all. So Brahman, in fact, Brahman has appeared. We mentioned Krishna, the incarnation of Brahman. Well, Brahman has also appeared as animals, because again, it's all Brahman. So ultimately, the animals are just being brought up in all this picture, sort of a cycle. The Hindu answer to the fall, or to what's wrong with us, basically boils down to two things. One, lack of knowledge. Again, Maya. We don't know we're God. And in fact, their answer to good and evil is basically we just need to realize that we're God. Because they say, if I realize I'm God and I realize you're God, of course I'm going to be nice to you. Of course I'm going to be good to you. Because why would I hurt myself? There's actually, that's an illustration, you know, why would I stab myself in the leg? That's what I'm doing if I harm you. So lack of knowledge because of Maya is one answer to the fall. The other thing is, again, the karmic cycle. So remember, if I do bad things in this life, I punch a puppy. Well, next life, I'm going to come back with a certain set of inclinations which are going to make me lower, as it were. It's going to be harder for me to be enlightened. But then, of course, until I've worked off that karmic debt, I'm likely to do worse things. So that sets me up then. So I'm fallen as David Vogel. I have sin and badness in me because of stuff that I did before. Of course, the obvious question, you know, we look for the Terminator. Where, not Arnold Schwarzenegger, but where does it begin? I mean, why was the first person? Where did the bad karma initially come from? And that typically, again, would be chalked up to Maya. We become separate from Brahman. We become subject to illusion. We forget we're God. We do bad things. And the cycle begins.
So to go back to that, so David Vogel works really hard, makes it through the whole cycle.
Well, remember, because this is, how would I know? Again, that's how would I know that if I'm just trying to make it up? You know, I try to understand as best I can. So typically, I don't think they would say categorically no, but more the picture is once you become absorbed into Brahman, then you're Brahman. Again, that's the end. Right. Yeah. Right. Honestly, I think what most Hindu teachers would say is we just don't know. There's a great desire to, again, to guard the unknowability of God. You know, we know this part, we know enough. We know that you need to do good things so you can become, you know, one with Brahman, but we don't fully understand, which again, without, you know, of course they don't fully understand. I don't fully understand, and I have the word of God. I think they would basically just say we don't know. You know, is it just a cycle? You know, Brahman breaks off more parts and we continue, or ultimately would it end? You know, do all the things get worked through into Brahman? And I don't believe there's a consensus among Hindus on that question. And again, you see, you're trying to put the Western logical categories.
Their purpose to it.
Exactly. Yeah, and they would say that's not, you're thinking about it wrong. Another good question. So everything is Brahman, but Brahman is expressed more in some than in others. Remember, they love analogies. So one analogy that I saw was this. If you imagine 4 100-watt light bulbs, if you put in all those light bulbs, they're all 100-watt light bulbs. I and this and the pile of dung are all Brahman equally. However, if you cover one of the 100-watt light bulbs with 4 layers of paper, 100-watt light bulb with 3 layers of paper, one with 2 layers of paper, and leave the other empty, you know, open, there's going to be more light emitting out of the one that's uncovered by paper. So essentially, the Hindu would say, and this is incidentally another misconception we sometimes have about Hinduism. We think of, again, you know, they worship animals or something like that. And typically what they would say is, yes, the animal is Brahman, but the animal is a lower expression of Brahman than you would be. And the enlightened sage is a higher expression of Brahman than you. And ultimately, then, Brahman himself is the highest expression of Brahman, even though, of course, again, I slipped into my Western categories of logical thinking when I say Brahman himself, because everything ultimately is Brahman himself, they would say.
Even Maya? Is that
also Brahman? That is right. That is, yes, ultimately. Again, logic and illogic also are all contained in him. So he just expresses out. And you can't say, well, that's bad. Well, he contains bad, just like he contains good. And neither of them are meaningful categories for the Hindu, ultimately. Did I see another hand? Yes, sir.
Americanized version
Right.
Can you speak to that?
Well, again, I think you're distinguishing to some extent between, you know, the traditional theological Hinduism and the more Western sort of pop manifestations of it, where, yeah, you see all sorts of different expressions of it. And again, the New Age movement is very much influenced by this sort of thought as well. But, of course, they put their distinctive spin on it. So I guess I would basically say, first of all, a Hindu is not going to care that much whether, you know, what you emphasize, because, again, that's just your path. If you want to think about just reincarnation being your theological emphasis, well, then go for it. If you want to focus on seeking nirvana, go for it. I mean, if you read Hindu documents or, you know, religious writings, they'll lay out four different, you know, there's different ways to categorize it, but paths to salvation. There's the intellectual path, the emotional path, there's the path of intellect, doing good, doing works, and meditation, I believe, are the four primary paths. So again, any of those are paths that may work for the person to ultimately get them to that God realization, which for a Hindu who's thinking about it, for a Hindu who is theologically inclined, that's what they're going for. For, you know, your more typical person who's just in this religion, basically just try and be a good person, and that'll help. And again, that's what religion boils down to, whether it's the, you know, the Muslim, whether it's the Hindu, whether it's the Christian, who, you know, again, just has, again, that sort of Americanized pop Christianity of just do good things and good things happen to you. And it boils down to that wherever you start, if you don't cling to what your revelation for a Christian, or to just your scriptures for another religion. We're hungry, Jeff.
How much interaction does the religion of Hinduism have with the societal structure of the caste system?
Very good question. So caste system.
Because if you're, like, you're untouchable.
Right.
You're untouchable.
Right. Right.
There seems to be a level of progression that you can perceive spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, higher state,
right.
But that's demarcated from their societal position.
That's like six different things that we'll talk about in a month. So anyway, let me give you your basic answer, though. Is first of all, again, why are you untouchable, or why are you? You can even be reincarnated as an animal, or you can be reincarnated as whatever. Why does that happen to you? Because of bad karma. And if you think about it, if I try and help you, that's bad, because I'm keeping you from paying off the bad karma. It's like, you know, if I've got a loose tooth, just pull it out and be done with it. If my mom's sitting there trying to super glue it back into my head, that really makes things worse, ultimately. So don't help the person paying off karmic debt. In fact, again, I was just reading a Hindu describing how some people, when they've done really bad things, they'll be born as a child and then immediately die. And then they'll be born again and immediately die. And again, that's just a quick, efficient way to work off your bad karmic debt. So somebody who's untouchable, there's not so much a view of, you know, you dramatically improve your spiritual condition in a single lifetime. You can to some extent, but to some extent, karma sets you a basic trajectory, and then, you know, you can bring things up or bring things down, but you're staging for the next cycle of reincarnation. The last thing that I just find interesting, sort of coming back to a theme I started with, is a lot of Westerners think of Hinduism as being illogical, unphilosophical. I would actually argue it is about as philosophical, about as logical as you can get, again, without revelation. If I do not have anything but myself trying to understand the world, does it not make sense? Again, there's a God who's off in the distance. You know, I'm trying to do my best. There's something special about me, but there's something wrong with me. It is a logically coherent system. But it's a system, again, that has none of the revelation of God come to us, not because, again, we're good, but because of his grace. And just, you know, something that I know I will think about this week is just a gratitude that I don't have to find things out for myself, you know, in my pursuit of God. So in the interest of time and getting to our fellowship meal, we'll go ahead and wrap that up. If you have great questions, save them for a month. And we'll see you guys next time. All right, you're dismissed. Fellowship meal.